There's a lot of different ways to get down to the beach from the cabin. We have a path that goes down the back patio, down through salal, bushes, and then through a creek onto the dunes. But that creek pathway isn't always super accessible. We found that this year, going out our back door onto the road and then finding a public access beach pathway is the best way to get down the beach. There's fences on both sides, but still, you know, Oregon greenery takes over around them. Some blackberries, some salal bushes, some ferns. And one of my favorite features of that path is that there's a caution sign at the end of it. Like, caution, the beach is dangerous.
Dangerous beach.
But we just cruise past that and we make it onto the beach. And at that point, it's really soft. White, golden, sandy beach and dune. There's grass overhead high for us. We're a pretty short family. And then driftwood pieces that have dried out in the sun. And at that point, the beach really opens up and it's wide and it's expansive. Especially when it's low tide, we can have a couple hundred yards of open beach, which is incredible.
Welcome to Patagonia Stories. I'm your host, Archana Ram. Today I speak with a family that's thought a lot about running and what it means for their relationship to disability. Stay tuned for more from sisters Kiko and Kira Sweeney. Also on today's show, journalist Sofia Arredondo shares the story of one of the fathers of Mexican rock climbing. Then we visit with Valen Terry at the Patagonia Archives in Ventura, California. Terry tells us about her favorite item from back in the day, before Yvon Chouinard made clothes, when he was still selling stuff out of his car. We'll be right back. This is Patagonia Stories. I'm Archana Ram. Our first story takes us to the beach.
My name is Kiko Sweeney. I work for Patagonia as a customer experience supervisor.
Hi, I'm Kira Sweeney. I'm Kiko's sister. I am a recent law school graduate, and I'm about to start working at the Disability Law Center in Boston.
When we were growing up, we would come here as a family, usually once a year and oftentimes in the summer.
Some of my favorite memories with Kiko are racing her to the water as soon as we'd get here to Manzanita.
That was probably the first running that I can remember, but I didn't necessarily think of it as running, but it absolutely was. And I think it contributes to that sense of why running feels so instinctual. It's just a pattern that we've built over time. We are currently in Manzanita, Oregon, which is a sleepy town on the Oregon coast. It's a place that our family has spent a lot of time throughout the years, from my dad and my grandma down now to us and me and my sister, Kira. We've been really lucky to spend a lot of time here throughout our lives.
Manzanita is really one of the first places where I learned how to play outside. I mean, in school, I didn't always play outside. I was more of kind of the kid who would be sitting there reading a book or something like that. But in Manzanita, I would build a sandcastle or I would run around looking for shells.
Running is a passion that our whole family shares. Oftentimes, it's a focal point of our time together, especially when we're all able to run.
As a family, while we're here, we usually spend a lot of time running. We go for a run every morning when we're here.
We also, when we're not together, separately participate in running. I run several days a week when I can. My mom and dad also run.
Usually I run with someone using a tether.
The tether gives a little more flexibility and movement while still staying close. My dad actually made that. I mean, they make other tethers you can buy online, and people use different things. People use shoelaces and like those strings on hoodies and things like that. But my dad made this out of like climbing carabiners, and I was about 6 years old.
I am blind. I've been blind for my entire life since birth. I feel it more at certain times than others. For example, maybe if I want to go for a run, but I don't have a running guide available in that moment, or things like that. My running practice is not always consistent, but it's always something I come back to, and a lot of that is because of the connection that it's allowed me to have with my family. Like, now I can understand what they love about it, and I can share that with them.
It's a bond that we have across space and time, and so when we get to be here in Manzanita, it makes it even more special and really unique for our family.
All right. Do you want to run to the edge?
Yeah.
Okay, are we just gonna run forward?
Yep.
I pay a lot of attention to the sound of the waves and the sound of the wind here. I find those very calming. And also just feeling the cool breezes from the ocean and feeling the sand under my feet. Because this beach has so much open space, I'm not going to run into anything. There's nothing to run into. And so when we get to the beach, I just stop holding on to the tether usually, or someone's arm. And basically my family says, all right, Kira, you can take off running. And I do. It's just extremely liberating. I feel like it gives me a lot more freedom of movement than I'm used to having. I move a lot faster than I always do in normal life, and I feel much more strong and capable in my body than I usually feel. Running on the beach here never seemed scary to me at all. It just felt like such a familiar environment, and it felt like really nothing could hurt me here. It felt like the environment was supporting me in my running and in my adventures.
Running, to me, it really is an instinct. I feel the lack of it when I don't do it. When I'm running, I feel strong and I feel beautiful and I feel a wholeness. When I'm on either the road or the trail or here at the beach, running's also been really helpful for me in understanding my disability as someone who has chronic migraines. So there'll be times when I really can't run for a while, and that's tough.
Kiko and I especially can relate, because we can't always just get out the door and run when we want to. For me, it's maybe I don't have a guide or access to a treadmill nearby, and for her, it's her migraines.
And so being able to relate on that level and have like a really deep sense of empathy and what that physically and emotionally means, it's a really powerful way to connect as a family.
The foam again, Kira? Oh, the foam. The sea foam latte. Going out with a surfboard.
These runs can be pretty long, so it gives us chances to have long conversations where maybe the conversation gets a little bit deeper than it would on the phone or at dinner or something like that. And I've gotten a lot of great advice from my parents and my sister on these runs.
Running, you start, you get to a point, and you turn around and you come back. Like, in some ways you've really accomplished nothing, but at the same time you've kind of accomplished everything. Running is hard, and so getting to do that all together and having that collective experience of building resilience, especially for us when, you know, maybe our bodies are functioning differently sometimes, that's really a powerful experience.
being out on the beach and hearing the waves, it just reminds me to slow down and appreciate life and appreciate what's around me, to be present.
That was Kiko and Kira Sweeney. You can find links to photos and a written version of their story in our show notes. Finding your place in the outdoors sometimes means paving a new path, building new routes, trying new techniques, crafting your own equipment. When some see problems, others see solutions, a way in. Take Raul Revilla Quiroz, one of the fathers of Mexican rock climbing. He made his own gear back in the 1940s and 50s. He specialized in hiking boots. Through testing out his products, he established a tight-knit climbing community in Pachuca, Mexico.
His first job, when he was only 9 years old, was at Tempac Industrial Shoe Factory in Pachuca. And there he learned the trade. By the early 60s, he became the first shoemaker to offer like a solid waterproof boots that could take adventures to the country's heights. And he dedicates nights and days to developing these famous Revilla boots, also climbing shoes, always searching for the lifelong lasting quality.
Raul was born on January 23, 1923, in the state of Hidalgo. His early years forged his personality. In the absence of his parents, a very young Raul was raised by a close friend of his mother's, Doña Aurelia. She raised him as her own son. Together, they overcame difficulties like a typhoid epidemic and poverty.
He had to design his own equipment. He first worked with a blacksmith to create pitons, pegs, and he took an idea from the book The First of the Rope and created his first bent wire carabiner with a train rail, which he adapted into a wire gate. From then on, it was no longer necessary to risk one's life by untying the rope from the waist to lead.
That was Sofia Arredondo. She's a journalist from Mexico City working on a film about the legacy of Raul Revilla.
I met him personally and immediately I felt like a great respect of his life. He was such a kind person with a lot of calm and he was always like silent and with carefully movements. And he's a legend, right? But he loved to speak a lot about his climbing days and the history of his life.
Raul passed away earlier this year at the age of 99. His death had an impact on the Mexican climbing community. His nickname was El Maestro, and he transformed the sport. With Raul gone, Sofia turned to his son Alfredo to learn more about his life.
Bueno, mi nombre es José Alfredo Revilla Sandoval. Mi padre es Raúl Revilla Quiroz, que en paz descanse.
The first time that I went, I ate with the family, with Alfredo, and it was a very nice afternoon, talking a lot about the story of the life of Raúl Revilla and looking at the mountains, the landscape of Pachuca. Pachuca, Don Raul's hometown, has incredible views. It's a small city that is surrounded by mountains with rock walls that can be seen from like far away, from distance. Alfredo told me that his father felt always, from a very, very young age, the need to climb the walls. Like when Raul would go hiking with his friends, they were like, okay, we can have a hike or just a walk outdoors. And he was like, no.
No, a mí no me interesa eso. Yo quiero subir.
Let's try to climb the walls.
La escalada sin saberlo, ¿no? Se agarraron, se
fue. They started to venture into climbing without knowing it, right? They just latched on to it. They just went, they saw it. They started with the Tampico fiber rope. They left two people down so they could call someone in case something happened. They overcame a difficult step, they got over it, up the chimney, and then came down. That's where all his climbing began to develop.
And in those years, when Don Raul started climbing, the equipment was extremely rudimentary. For example, in the beginning, they didn't have carabiners, so they had to untie the rope, put it through the ring, and tie it back on. So they were left without any kind of protection at 20 or 30 meters high. Climbing at those days was so terrifying. Yeah, it was very dangerous. And in that type of climbing, they could not fall. A fall could cost them their lives. Héctor Ponce de León, one of the greatest alpinists and climbers nowadays, he saw climbing gear that was used by Raul Revilla, and he says, like, no, no, no. I can hang there even a photo. It was an innate impulse, something that he always wanted to do. And I think that for the first time he was at the top of a wall or a mountain and having another perspective of the landscape from there is something that will absolutely have captivated Don Raul. He loved to climb there.
He
used to make a comment in particular, like, how wonderful it is from this height, right? The way he saw things, he observed, and it caused a special sensation in him. It was something fabulous to him.
As soon as Don Raul started climbing, he began to open hundreds of routes around his home. To open a route, it's that you climb this wall, this line on the wall, for the first time. So nobody before had tried it.
Climbing is a lot safer now than it used to be. Equipment failure is rare and almost always involves some kind of user error. Raul's gear played a big part in making climbing a safer sport.
It was his philosophy of life. Not to see the problems, but to find the solutions. If he had not had that personality, probably today climbing in Mexico would be different. The fact that he looked for the way to climb the walls was what led, along with other great climbers, to the fact that today we have so much climbing in the state of Hidalgo and in Mexico in general.
Raul also needed the right footwear, which he developed on his own. His son Alfredo still handcrafts the legendary Revilla boots today.
Alfredo grew up in the same place where is their home and their workshop. Each one of them, all the family, learned to make the boots. They make the sole of the shoe with airplane tires, and they use national leather. And yeah, everything is handcraft. And also they make them to your size. They don't have a general size. Like, they take the foot size personally.
Exactamente, te tomamos la plantilla.
Exactly. We make a mold of your foot to get the shape. Sometimes there are bumps like a bunion. Sometimes there are spurs, as they call them, which is right on the heel.
El espolón que le llaman, que está justo en el talón.
The mold is conditioned in such a way that this kind of bump does not cause any discomfort when the shoes are in use.
Wearing Raul Revilla boots is undoubtedly carrying on your feet the history of the Mexican climbing and mountaineering, right? You are carrying on a legacy. Having access to climbing is not only having access to a recreation, to a hobby, to a therapy, but to a sport that demands a lifestyle, a way of developing in nature, a way of connecting with it that implies understanding it, knowing it, observing it, suffering it, valuing it.
El plano vertical siempre ofrece un sentido.
The vertical plane always offers some meaning. I'd call it spiritual, because it brings you some satisfaction and you begin to experience peace of mind, even to carry on with life, right?
Incluso hasta de tranquilidad para proseguir en la vida, ¿no?
I believe that Don Raúl is a great reference in the history of Mexico outdoors for having developed material that allowed him to reach places where no one had ever been. He, along with other great climbers, made it possible for many of us to enjoy this outdoor sport and for sure gave us access to those places that you can only access with a rope and climbing shoes. And I think that's amazing.
Me sirvo en tomar el legado que él deja de la fabricación de zapato para alpinista en las ramas de la escalada, de caminata y de la montaña. Y quedo a sus órdenes.
There's no exact data on how many first ascents Raúl made, but there's certainly more than we think. And although he's largely remembered for the footwear and climbing gear he developed as part of his mountain climbing philosophy, what he left behind goes much further. You can find a link to read the story and watch the accompanying film celebrating the life and work of Don Raúl Rivia in our show notes. At the Patagonia Archives, it's not just about preserving the memorabilia or the clothes. It's also about the personal stories behind them.
Hi, I'm Terry.
And I'm Val.
Welcome to the Patagonia Archives.
Val and Terry have accumulated a lot of stuff over the years. I talked to them about how it all gets sorted and how well-loved gear makes its way back to Ventura.
So there's jackets, there's waders, there's marketing materials, there's a board game over there. What are the Patagonia Archives? What's in here?
We've got about 4,000 pieces of Chouinard equipment here, not only hardware, but software, the clothing side of the company that we started to build to protect them and their elements, and then beyond, the stories, the weekly reports, the photography that represents our history. It wasn't hard to collect. It was actually almost all free. Most people just donated what they had. Older reps who have a collection from the 70s just brought most of their samples in, so they're like brand new and almost time capsuled.
People have kind of a cathartic experience when they walk in here if they've been a past employee and they see that we're honoring the work that they've done over the years and it hasn't been forgotten and we tell those stories and we pass on that legacy that they helped us build.
We can't move fast enough. There's hundreds of people I'd like to get their stories in here.
When Val and I first came together to build this archive, we didn't have a space to store things. We didn't know anything about archiving.
And so what happens when an article used to come in, we put it in a box and try to remember where it was, but now we have a collections manager, Darcy Moore. So we call her the new sheriff in town because she will watch something come in the door and immediately want to process it. And by processing, I mean she identifies what it is, she gives it a location, she gets it ready for a photograph. So it's Darcy's role to put a number on an object and put it in a place that we know we can find it.
We've collected the stories of past employees through oral interviews, and Val's done close to 100 of those interviews, and we transcribe them and then store them for the future.
We really think it's magical. I mean, what's happened in here, we can't even understand how it happened. The people we're partnered with in this archive, everybody who works here, we will use those terms, oh, yeah, it's meant to be, it's another magical moment, you know, it's just happening.
Today, they've picked out Terry's favorite item, an old Yosemite hammer, used in climbing to nail hardware into rock.
Let's talk about this hammer. So, Terry, I know this is one of your favorite pieces in the archives, and It dates back to a time when Yvon Chouinard, the founder of Patagonia, who's also a mountaineer, a surfer, you know, that's what he's known for, but he also used to sell stuff out of the back of his car.
Right.
And that's where this hammer story starts from.
So this young man who had just graduated from high school and had a couple of years experience climbing decided to take a seminar from Yvon. He said he saved his money for it, and he signed up. And one of the things he notices is Yvon had this Yosemite hammer that he really kind of coveted. So he asked Yvon if he could buy one, and he said, you know, this is a prototype, but I am going into production with these, so if you give me $8.50 and 50 cents shipping and handling, I'll send one to you. And so he shelled out the money, and he thought, I might never see this hammer, but in good faith, he ended up purchasing it. And sure enough, a couple of months later, he received the hammer, and it was of the quality he expected it to be. Fast forward another year or two, and he gets drafted into the Vietnam War and gets injured in the artillery, and he damages his hearing and loses his sense of balance. So after that, he couldn't climb anymore, so he held onto the hammer, and he did a lot of camping, and he learned how to fly fish over the years, and he used it to pound in many a tent stake. So this hammer was purchased in 1966, and 40 years later, in 2006, he returns the hammer to us with the original invoice for $9 and a letter saying, in 1985, I purchased my first Patagonia fishing vest, still nothing wrong with it. My assortment of waders and clothing will never fail me. 40 years ago, I thought, this is a guy with integrity. You proved me right. I'm returning the hammer to you. It needs to be in an archive somewhere.
Yeah, and I think that's what's cool about gear and clothing. You know, sometimes they're our best companions on our trips, our most epic moments, like those life-changing moments. And sometimes, you know, they're the only companions. And I feel like you can get that sense from this man, Jacob, that this was a companion for him through many different phases of his life. What do you see with something like this or the kind of gear that you bring in about people really built a relationship with their gear?
I think that's true for many objects in here. I think that's the part that makes it cathartic. They come in, they recognize their old friends, these Patagonia objects, and they connect that time and that memory, be it sweet or hard, and it is part of the magic here. So these objects all had a life. Every one of them had a life. So when you come in and connect all those together, it's like, you hear us saying this a lot, oh, wow, oh, wow. You know, when you hear a story like the one Terry's sharing right now, it's like, oh, wow.
It makes me wonder, like, when we all hear a piece of music from our teenage years, like, it really brings back that time to us. And I think the same way with our gear, that it really brings back memories.
That's what's so cool about the archives is those memories actually live on.
And we've lived them. We were there when the book was built, or we were part of managing something when a garment was sewn, or a display was going up because Terry helped to create it. So the collective knowledge makes it come to life. We come in every day and we continue to live it, past, present, and future.
Our interviews today got me thinking about the polar opposite reactions we can have to the outdoors. Some spots feel foreign to us, or worse, they feel off limits. Going in feels wrong or unapproachable. But then there are those places that feel familiar and safe. Everything that usually holds us back doesn't matter here. We actually feel supported by the environment. To me, that's what's beautiful about our favorite spaces outdoors. Like Kira said, they give us permission to be playful. We don't have to hit every summit or run the trail for a personal record. We don't have to be perfect. Raul wanted to climb just because he loved that feeling from the higher altitude, the fresh perspective. That's why our favorite places in nature are so powerful. They make us feel whole, they let us be ourselves, and they make sure we have a damn good time while we're there. Next time on Patagonia Stories.
It was just like one of those cartoons where the light bulb goes off. I thought, oh my God, plants aren't just takers, they're also givers.
If you want to learn more about our guests, check out our website, patagonia.com/stories, where you'll find films and written articles from the season. Patagonia Stories is produced by
Terrence Bernardo, Jenny Cataldo, Morgan Flannery, and Jocelyn Gonzalez of PRX Productions. Voiceover by Mark Pagan. Our executive producers at Patagonia are Tristan Cimini, Megan Brown, and Alex Lowther. I'm Archana Ram. Patagonia Stories is a production of PRX.